and it's going to bring good things, but it's not here yet. And in that context, there are two very different set of issues that need to be addressed regarding local competition. The first is the set of issues that need to be addressed in order to let local competition happen. This bill does nothing in that regard. It is supposedly to encourage competition. You cannot find those words in the bill. One would think that it would say local phone service competition should be encouraged. It doesn't say that. It doesn't even say it shall be allowed. Not only does it not even make the statement that local phone competition is allowed and should be encouraged, there are a host of issues that have to be addressed before local phone service competition can happen. And Mr. Meninsky and some of the other people talked about some of these. Interconnection is the most basic. If I'm in the competitive local phone business and I want to go to you to get you to sign up for my business, you obviously will not sign up for my business if you can't call any of the people who remain on ATU's system. So you have to have interconnection between the two networks so that the people who sign up for the new provider can call the people who are still on the old provider. Interconnection in this business means much more than that. And these are some of the kind of details that have to be worked out, which are totally unaddressed. For instance, one is called number portability. The particular phone number that people have, and particularly that businesses have, is often very important to them. My parents own a bookstore, and they have the phone number 782-BOOK, B-O-O-K. We're all familiar. You see a lot with 800 numbers. Frequently, it is because the number describes the business in some way. And even if you don't have that, any business has stationery, advertisements, all sorts of things that have their phone number already there. They have a real problem going to a new customer if they have to change their phone number. Now, this is something that the long distance company went through with 800 numbers. Now, if you have an 800 number and you change from Alascom to GCI or vice versa, from AT&T to MCI, you keep your same 800 number. You do not have to give up your number when you change carriers. That's also necessary at the local level in order to have any real competition at the local level. There must be something called dialing parity, which means that you don't have the situation that you may remember for a long time ago, where if you wanted to use GCI as your long-distance carrier, you had to dial a long series of numbers as compared to using Alascom, where you only had to dial the 7 numbers plus the area code. The local phone customers can't be required to dial, say, 10 numbers, while the new competitor's customers can't be required to dial, say, 10 numbers, while the existing carrier's customers only dial 7 numbers. It's a major barrier. It's something that has to be worked out in the interconnection. These are the kind of issues which are addressed by the legislation in other states where they say they're going to have full local competition, because you can't have it without addressing these matters. But the bill that's been put forward thus far doesn't address those issues. Instead, it addresses only the second set of issues. And that second set of issues concern the changes in the regulations.
That subject to your approval that we had talked about following Mr. Edrington and preceding Mr. Foster, but I'm prepared to testify whenever it's your pleasure, sir.
Well, we can hold off. I just didn't know if you were under any time constraints.
No, certainly not. That would compel me to go right now. I'm here at your pleasure, sir.
Okay, if that's the case, then I'd rather we just follow the flow of things based on who signed in at what time. So first of all, dealing with this matter, I want to call. Ms. McKee.
My name name is Charles McKee. I'm speaking on House Bill 346, and it's entitled An Act Relating to Regulation of a Telecommunication Utility. It also is listed on the docket with the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, dated September 27th, 1995, which is today, R-399. I was there earlier, and I have a difficulty with the lawyers that are working with the Alaska Public Utilities Commission and their determination of the act before us, as well as their determination as to when someone could speak on our docketed document or regulatory process if the person hasn't filed prior to in writing wishing to make public comment also when it comes up on the docket. And the reason being is the legal counsel working for the state of Alaska has allowed a situation to continue to such an extent that I was forced to file a claim of lien issued to the governor September 21st, 1995, and I'll read into the record. Claim of lien. Keep in mind the Republic was being attacked from within while the 14th Amendment was being proposed. The intent was the artificial legal person, i.e. the corporation, would have a perpetual life more so than the communist mind. Also knowing they would become involved by grant of state, the Constitution states, in part, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment for debt, thereby invalidating the grant. Also, in what manner had the artificial person tendered payment for the grant by state? Now, I didn't turn this into the Department of Law because I would have received a gag order instantly because they are the defendants. How can they defend themselves if I make this issue public that they've been skirting, shall we say, justice all these years? And now we've been a state for 25, a little bit longer. This is part of the national constitution, the state constitution. And of course, the reason why I did this is because I don't want to discriminate. Resolution passed by the municipality, as well as the school board in the municipality, the largest school board in the state, passed resolutions, non-discriminatory resolutions. But yet, these individuals and organizations, or enlarged, wish to discriminate against me. One of my interests is to buy ATU, Anchorage Telephone Utility, in conjunction with the trust that's supposed to support the public library structure. Of course, that's fiber, reading material, financially. And conjunction, take that foundation and take it and marriage it with the county department of ATU and also deal with the mining aspect. I have a 1950 Mining Regulatory Act that's territorial, federal and territorial of the state of Alaska. That's how this state was brought into recognition as a state, because of the mineral extraction and the money made off of the seafood industry, the salmon industry. You can see one of the plaques out there on the sidewalk next to Westward Hilton. That was the money fish. It was referred to as the money fish. Historically, that was what it was called, and you can see it out there on the corner of 3rd West North Corner. I've also given this to the Speaker of House, as well as the Senate President, as well as other corporations in town. So I give you a copy, but not one of the original notary public sealed ones, in reference to the bill. they're dealing here, I suspect, is dealing with paid telephones. Of course, you're using coin, which to some degree makes it a legal purchase, but you're buying time. Part of my mathematical equation is it's a conclusion of time, as well as the fact that the seal, you know, it's the original signet. I have the right to stamp. And, but of course, when I refer to the communist mind, I'm not referring to flesh and blood, am I? Principalities and high places? That's what I'm referring to. And of course, my weapon is not of warfare of the flesh, but is powerful by God for overturning strongly entrenched things. For we are overturning reasonings and very lofty things that raise up against the knowledge of God, and we are bringing every thought into the captivity to make it obedient to Christ. I just read scripture there. You might be familiar with it. And so the incorporated entity is invalidated simply because we went from wartime currency to peacetime currency today.
Mr. Key, can you please summarize?
I thought I did.
That concludes your testimony?
Yeah.
Questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Mr. Sharar from the APUC. And you're here.
I'm just here to answer questions. I can make
questions, observe. I'll tell you what, we'll move along then. And if there are questions, I know that you did have a work session this past Monday. I was out of town.
I might make a few comments here. Maybe I won't get another chance to talk.
My staff was there and I was unable to attend to another.
Yeah, we did have a workshop on Monday this week, and on which ATU, ATA, GCI, Alascom, and AT&T Alascom all attended. And my main purpose here today is just to answer any questions you folks may have regarding the fiscal note we put out. And I brought Mr. Lohr along. He's the technician on this. I'd like to say this, you know, this bill is the basis of it, I believe, is to promote competition. And we in no way are opposed to that whatsoever, that we'll do whatever we can to ensure that goes along. And our main reason for being here today is to answer any questions you may have on that fiscal note we've put out. We have not formally taken a position on this bill. We have not been asked to. I do have a copy of the tapes here. I'll leave with you of that workshop we had Monday, and we will have a transcript as soon as it's completed.
Great. Just one question. Since the bill, I think what I heard the sponsor suggest is that it is there to facilitate competition. Is there more regulation involving us getting to a more competitive state?
Well, again, it depends on the final. There's much regulation going to be needed in order to, in the present form of the bill. Now, when we had our workshop Monday, the A2 representative, when we counted them 8 different times, he mentioned we'd have to be developing some regs to enforce different or to put in action different parts of the bill. So, but until it's trashed out of what we come out with, I couldn't really give you a definitive answer. Yes, there would be more regulation in order the way the bill presently reads.
General Roper? Oh, let's hold back, right?
Okay.
So if you have any questions on the fiscal loan stuff, I'll be here.
Mr. Edrington.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Edrington, and I'm General Manager of ATU Telecommunications. And I'm here today with Mark Foster, who's to my right, and Chip Shushan, who's in Bethesda, Maryland at the moment. I've personally been in the telephone industry for 25-plus years, retiring as a Vice President of Pacific Bell before coming to Alaska. My area of expertise is focused on technology evaluation, implementation, and policy impacts. Mark's been a commissioner with the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, and Chip has been involved in telecommunications strategy legislation at the national level for many years. We're here today to talk about HB 346, and I would like to offer just some very simple observations about the bill that I think we should be good to remember as we get caught in the details of this as these hearings progress. First is the legislation is necessary and mainstream. Telecommunications policy at the national level is undergoing profound change, and that legislation, should it pass, will leave wide discretion to the states in its administrative implementation. Alaska needs to be prepared to meet that challenge should that legislation pass. Secondarily is to mainstream. Over 30 states currently have similar legislation on the books, the first such legislation being passed in 1983. This is not a radical proposal. This is a moderate proposal. The second point to keep in mind is Alaska's scope and scale. In Alaska, at least two of the companies, GCI and ATU, have net incomes of around $10 million annually. Much of this legislation was built around a titanic struggle between the Bell operating companies, the Baby Bells, and the long-distance carriers, where there are net income streams of $1 billion a year and hundreds of millions of subscribers. So when you look at Alaska, you do need to make some accounting for the fact that things are different here and smaller, both in the way we regulate our long-distance services as well as the way we regulate our local services. The things that apply in huge scale don't necessarily work in the small scale of Alaska. And finally, technology has changed the economics of the telecommunications industry fairly dramatically. People just recently paid over $7 billion for licenses for PCS, which is a radio frequency capability to communicate directly with customers. In Alaska, we have two parties who paid over $1 million for those licenses. Basically, technology has removed most of the barriers to entry in this market and made entry into the market quite affordable on a number of fronts. So as we go forward with this, to summarize very briefly my comments, I think we need to keep in mind the legislation is mainstream, it's moderate. We do need to take into account Alaska's scale and scope when setting rules, and that the technology has changed the nature of this industry considerably. That concludes my remarks. I have a copy of my testimony I'll make available. Recorder. And I'd like to turn it over now to Mr. Shushan, who's in Washington.
Yeah, Mr. Shushan. Mr. Shushan?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and other members of the committee for accommodating my schedule and permitting me to appear before you, as it were, today by telephone. I realize this is a less than ideal way of changing my views with you today. I hope that in the months ahead, when I contemplate being in Alaska, that we'll have an opportunity to sit down face-to-face and discuss these issues. I know also that you've had a long day, so what I'd like to do is submit the prepared statement I have, plus a summary of that statement and my biographical information for the record, and I'll take a few minutes just to summarize my views. I was surfing the internet the other day, and I came across a page of facts about Alaska. It noted, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, that the state fossil in Alaska is the woolly mammoth. Well, when reading through the Alaska Public Utility Code the other day, I was struck that it could easily be referred to as the woolly mammoth of utility law. It really is a fossil, an artifact of another era. Now, I understand that some parties may urge you in the course of these hearings to preserve this fossil, to stick with the status quo. However, I suggest that you dispatch it to the Public Policy Museum. I believe that you need new regulatory tools in Alaska and a new public policy direction. and I applaud you, Mr. Chairman, along with Representative Moses, for getting the process started. On the whole, I believe that House Bill 346, the Alaska Telecommunications Act of 1995, provides a sound basis for revamping the Alaska Code to permit efficient competition, and that it will help to usher in an era of new opportunities, as ATU suggests. It's a fundamental principle in our free economy that firms respond to incentives. Thus, the incentives provided by the marketplace or by regulation where necessary as a surrogate for marketplace forces are important. As the legislature, you have the opportunity to set the direction of public policy in this vital sector and to make certain that regulation provides the right incentives. In this case, incentives to invest, to innovate, and to supply quality service at appropriate prices. As competition intensifies, spurred by federal legislation as well as by actions you take in Alaska, regulation must adapt to the new environment. I believe you can and should move ahead without waiting for the enactment of federal legislation, nor should you be bound in any way by the specific approaches to the various issues taken in that federal legislation or in legislation adopted by other states for that matter. As I see it, the proposed act has three essential components. It seeks to provide for fair competition in establishing terms for interconnection and for access to essential facilities. It provides for streamlined regulation of new and competitive services. And while retaining traditional rate of return regulation, it modernizes the regulatory treatment of investment and depreciation. I would like to address each of these essential components in more detail, starting with interconnection. First, the obligation to interconnect should run both ways. That is, it should be symmetrically imposed on all competitors, not simply on the incumbent firm. Second, while some parties will undoubtedly urge you to go further by requiring ATU and other local telephone companies in Alaska to disaggregate their networks, requiring the interconnection of competitors is sufficient to permit local competition. The legitimate needs of competitors should be determined in part by who they are and by their relative positions in all telecommunications markets. ATU, for example, as was mentioned earlier, is not now in the long-distance business. However, it faces competitors who are large, formidable players in that business, including AT&T, the new owner of Alascom, and GCI with its partners MCI and BT, formerly British Telecom. These firms operate successfully in many markets around the world, offer a range of services, and possess substantial resources, including substantial expertise in wireless communications. And these resources will facilitate their vertical integration into the provision of local telephone service. In fact, these firms have the capability to bypass ATU's network completely to serve a wide range of customers. Third, the proposed act would require that the costs of any modifications or additions needed to facilitate interconnection are borne by competitors. In principle, this is unobjectionable. Fourth, and here's an area where I must say I have a concern with the proposed legislation, I am unclear about the effect of conditioning interconnection on the absence of, quote, injury to the owner or to other users of the facilities, close quote, and especially about removing the word substantial, which appears in the code today. If that language is read to require the APUC to consider whether competition generally might result in economic harm to a public utility, I'm concerned that such language could be used by incumbent firms to block efficient competitors from obtaining interconnection. Now I'd like to comment briefly on the second element of the bill, the streamlined regulation. As competition continues to develop, it's appropriate to tailor regulation to fit the new circumstances. This means allowing the incumbent firm to respond when competition exists for a particular service or group of services. The proposed act standard for classifying competitive services appropriately focuses on the availability of a substitute service and not, I would emphasize, on how many customers may actually choose to buy the substitute service. That's a form of measuring market share. And the problem with that latter approach is that it actually penalizes the incumbent firm for being an effective competitor. Or put another way, it forces the incumbent to lose share by being unresponsive to consumers' needs in order to gain regulatory flexibility. It's also important that firms have the incentive to introduce new services. By providing for streamlined regulation of those services, the proposed act will encourage regulated public utilities to innovate. Establishing a price floor, as the legislation would do, based on incremental cost, is well supported in the economic literature and consistent with the direction that public policy is going in other jurisdictions. The purpose of a price floor is to provide regulatory, in addition to antitrust protection, against predatory pricing by a firm with market power. Now, while competitors can be expected to argue to you that incumbent firms should be kept under tighter rein, I believe the legislation should seek to avoid, to the extent possible, a regime where the competition sets its prices based on the posted prices of the incumbent, and where competitors are able to reprice their services while tying up the incumbent in the regulatory process. The question was asked earlier about whether more regulation may be needed in the interim, and I suggest that the answer to that is probably yes, that regulation will be required during the transition to competition. But the goal of that regulation should be to protect competition and not to protect competitors from competition. The full benefits of competitive markets will only be realized if regulation is appropriately streamlined. It's important to make these changes now so the regulatory ground rules are clear for all parties in the future. The goal, after all, is to have competitors fight it out in the marketplace rather than in the hearing room. The third essential feature of the bill is its treatment of investment and depreciation. It would make important changes in the regulatory treatment of the valuation of property and the depreciation of investment made by public utilities. Let me summarize my views there even more succinctly by saying I believe these reforms are positive and I can support them fully, and they're certainly reflective of the direction that public policy is going in the federal arena and also in the states around the country where I've had the privilege to work. In conclusion then, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, overall, I believe the Alaska Telecommunications Act of 1995 moves public policy in the right direction. It provides for incremental rather than radical change and represents a measured approach to modernizing telecommunications regulation in Alaska. As such, the proposed act is certainly consistent with developments elsewhere and with sound public policy. Thank you again for your courtesy, and I'll stand by on the line to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schoen. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Schoen, could you comment on the your statement about the pending federal statutory changes and its relationship to this particular piece of legislation? As I recall, you indicated that you thought we should go ahead on our own with this. I think I understand that, but I'm kind of curious about, from your perspective of Washington, D.C., about what's happening down there as far as the federal statute.
Certainly, Representative, I'll be happy to. I do deal with this a little bit more at length in my full statement, but let me summarize by saying, as you're probably aware, both the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate have passed a major telecommunications reform legislation. I might add parenthetically that I think that in the Senate legislation, Alaska's interests have been extremely well articulated and protected by Senator Stevens. He has done yeoman work on behalf of the state in making sure that the special circumstances of Alaska are addressed in this legislation. We're waiting right now for a conference committee to be appointed, and then they will, as you know, proceed to work out the differences in the legislation. My feeling is, as someone who has been involved in the legislative process and spent 10 years on Capitol Hill, that we're probably closer than we've ever been to major reform on the federal level. In terms of the impact on Alaska, Representative, it seems to me that although the bill makes major changes in introducing local competition and opening markets to entry, it still preserves something that was very fundamental in the Communications Act of 1934, which is the federal statute that governs today. And that is the concept of dual jurisdiction. That is the fact that we will continue to see both the federal jurisdiction through the FCC and state jurisdiction, in this case by the APUC, maintained. And I think that the challenge to you is to move ahead with modernizing your statute to pave the way for the inevitable changes that will be coming, so that you know, Alaska can be sort of steering the ship as opposed to just being on board when the ship begins to turn. I think that there will continue to be an important role for the states. I think that you can begin to prepare yourself for that role by moving to change the code now. And I would say this, even if the federal legislation does not pass, and I give it a high probability of passing, I think that it is long overdue for you and the legislature to give a thorough review to the code and get on with reforms of that statute.
Mr. Schoen, this is Representative Cottigan, the chairman. I've got a question here regarding the same issue. It seems to be that I recall reading in the Wall Street Journal that there was some speculation that Congress would not address this matter in the conference committee perhaps until the middle of spring. Do you have any comment on that as to whether or not that is accurate, or is it just something that is speculative at best?
Well, I think right now, let's just say, let me tell you what isn't speculation. As I said, both houses have acted. The margin on final passage, in fact, on most of the key votes, was solidly in favor of the legislation, overwhelmingly in favor in terms of final passage. Obviously, and you know this well from your own legislative environment up there, there's a lot of jockeying for position right now. It's interesting. One of the things that's holding the process up is because this is monumental legislation, and because there are so many different aspects and angles involved, it's actually a plum now to get appointed to the conference committee. And so there's been a lot of jockeying around in the House of Representatives by various representatives who want to be on the conference committee. That's delayed things a bit. Also, right now, the focus is clearly in Congress on working out the budget impasse and getting beyond that. I would suspect that we will see conferees named within the next week or two. Staff discussions are already underway on an informal basis, and I would be very surprised if this thing is delayed into next spring. In fact, I'd be willing right now to predict that we'll see a bill out of conference before the end of the year, and then the question will be, what does the president do? The administration has threatened a veto, but I think that's largely to gain leverage for some of the concessions it wants to see in the House Senate conference. So, again, it's hard to predict, but I think with such overwhelming momentum that we're going to see something sooner rather than later.
That seems to be what the article was suggesting. Perhaps it would be at the end of the year. However, it did also mention that there was this commitment to America, i.e. Medicaid reform, welfare reform, those kind of issues that Congress had to urgently take up before the end of the year before they could pursue the Telecommunications Act. And I haven't looked at the numbers when that act was passed, so I don't know if the president has any fear of an override if he vetoes it. There was some concern, I guess, by the administration on the existing piece of legislation that passed, and there was some problem areas that I think the president would like to see worked out. So I haven't seen the numbers as far as how overwhelming that bill was supported in Congress, but I would suspect that there's not a major change that the president will veto it.
Well, you may be right, Mr. Chairman. My own view is that that he probably won't, and that we won't have to see whether there'll be an override. I'd like to emphasize, though, this. I think it's appropriate and necessary for you to try to understand what's going on at the federal level, but realizing, of course, that it is out of your hands. On the other hand, I want to emphasize what I said earlier, that even if federal legislation doesn't pass, or I might say especially if federal legislation doesn't pass, you know, these questions of how to accommodate competition and make sure that it's fair and efficient competition, how to streamline regulation, how to change the regulatory process, these are real issues that are being grappled with in states around the country. I'm privileged to do a fair amount of work in a number of states, and I must say, I hope my analogy at the outset wasn't offensive of the woolly mammoth, but I mean, I must say, you really are operating there under a sort of the old style approach to public utility regulation, and many states, in fact, I would say most states, have moved ahead. waiting for federal legislation to make necessary changes such as this. So I think that you should keep that in mind and would urge you to move ahead in any event.
Well, thank you for being with us today and appreciate your comments.
Thank you, sir.
And proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss HB 346. My name is Mark Foster. I served on the consumer and engineering seats on the Alaska Public Utilities Commission from 1990 through the end of 93. Since then, I've been involved in a number of consulting engagements, including utilities, natural gas feasibility studies, electric utilities, and I've done work for GCI, ATU, and commercial customers in the telecommunications arena. Today, I appear on behalf of ATU. Overall, HB 346 represents an incremental first step. It's a step away from command and control regulatory structures based on statutes which have remained substantially unchanged since the 70s with respect to local exchange markets. And it's a step toward the 1990s, where telecommunications markets are becoming increasingly competitive, and legislators and regulators across the country are streamlining regulations and finding ways to produce incentives for investments. As a former commissioner, I find one of the more troubling aspects of regulation is the question of its cost effectiveness. I'm familiar with many cases at the Alaska Public Utilities Commission where the regulatory process led to hundreds of thousands and in some cases millions of dollars being spent on staff, consultants, and lawyers to fight pitched hearing room battles that ultimately yielded very few benefits. This regulatory burden is ultimately paid for by all of us through higher rates and regulatory incentives, which discourage innovation and investment. I think it's important for us to find ways to encourage investment and to reduce the reliance on the hearing room as a place to fight out competitive battles. Given Alaska's unique geography and our increasing connection to a global economy, reforms aimed at reducing the regulatory burden and providing a vital and robust telecommunications sector are vital. This bill takes some important steps along that path by reducing regulatory burdens and allowing consumers and not the government to pick the winners and the losers in those competitive markets. What the bill does not do, it does not guarantee competitive outcomes. It reduces regulations and it lets the market make that determination. It does not guarantee that rates will remain unchanged. As competitive markets emerge, rates that have historically been subsidized are likely to experience upward pressure. This legislation provides opportunities for success and failure for both competitors and consumers. It does change the market structure. In the interest of time, I've got some additional testimony that's already been handed out, and I'd like that to be made part of the record. And with that, I make myself available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We have that testimony. We will include that as part of the record. Representative Roper.
Mr. Foster, your last statement there, I'm just kind of curious about it. You indicate that rates have been historically subsidized but are likely to experience upward pressure. Is that because of the changing technology, or is that because of the recommended changes in this statute, or what's the rationale for your statement?
I would say conventional wisdom in the industry is that residential rates have been subsidized historically by a combination of things. One is high long-distance access charges have contributed to residential rates. And I think as the markets become more competitive and people seek other alternatives to those access charges, it puts pressure on those subsidies. And I don't think they'll be sustained in the long run. And as a result, I think you'll see pressure on those kinds of rates that have been subsidized. So I'd say it's a combination of things. Technology is part of what's driving it. Also what's driving it, I think, is just a change in the regulatory structure to allow more competitive markets to develop.
And, Mr. Chairman, is that subsidy been, is that more unique to the Alaskan market, or is that nationally?
No, I would characterize that as national, and Tom can speak to that as well.
It's a national phenomenon, and as you correctly, I think, inferred in the technology question, Representative, the monopoly nature of this industry has all been obliterated by technology, And as the monopoly nature of an industry is obliterated and it moves into a more of a free market configuration, the ability to overcharge somebody, to undercharge somebody else, pretty well disappears over time. So we will face those kinds of transitions.
Further
questions? Mr. Foster, I have some. Mr. Ed. Would you like me to proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Are you prepared to comment on any particular section of the bill, or have you had the opportunity to peruse it,
personally?
Analyze it? Yes.
No, I'm not prepared to comment
on
particular sections.
I do have a couple
sections,
but
Mr. Foster
questions.
Is.
I'm just not sure who to ask. I know I missed at least one opportunity with the commissioner under the findings, but maybe, Mr. Foster, you can help me out on section 6. Talks about a trial basis to selected customers, and that's new service that telecommunications utility can provide. Can you enlighten me to some respect on what trial basis would be all about as far as the length, period, what type of service? Would it be any type?
I think in general the goal of that provision is to allow the existing regulated telecommunications utilities the opportunity to do market trials, just as their unregulated competitors are able to do today. And with respect to what would constitute a time period or what kind of service would be allowed under that provision, I think ultimately the Utilities Commission is charged with sort of policing, you know, the sort of the extremes of what that means and the boundaries. Let me try and think of what might be considered a market trial. It's conceivable that you would have a new service like caller ID in a number of states. Rather than rolling that out for everybody at once, some of the telecommunications utilities offer that on a trial basis to try and assess whether or not they could make the investment profitable if they rolled it out for everybody, rather than trying to take the risk of doing it all at once. I think that's things along those lines, I think, the kinds of things that are contemplated.
That answers my question. Moving ahead, then, Section 7 of the bill, it deals with a telecommunications utility expanding or offering a discounted service or reduced rate telecommunications to a number of other entities, generally supported by political apparatus. We are expanding, I think, existing law, federal law, I think under state or federal law. People who receive social assistance, some kind of social assistance benefit pursuant to a means test are offered. There's some reduction in rate, I think. That's not correct.
That's the existing statute that was passed in 1990. I'd say that's right, yeah.
Since these institutions here in this section are generally supported by a governmental body, what would be the impetus for a telecommunications firm or utility allowing this to expand?
I'd say it's largely in response to the demand that's been expressed, and I think the Utilities Commission could speak to this probably as well as anyone. In their Alaska 2001 process, there's a great demand, particularly among the schools and education facilities, for access to improved telecommunications and to the information money into that and an internal reallocation. I think that process is, you know, occurring ever so slowly in the state of Alaska. And I would say that today we're behind compared to other states in that process. And what this provision does is allow you to provide telecommunications companies to offer reduced rates to sort of assist in that endeavor to have more telecommunications access for those particular groups. And I think it's a very modest proposal, and it sort of gets us started down the road. And I'm not sure that any other system that I've heard described is going to get there as quickly as maybe we want to get there. And clearly it's a call for the legislature. I think it's offered up because it's quite common in most states in legislation along these lines is to allow increased access for those groups.
So, in essence, the private rate payers would be subsidizing.
No, I would characterize that as not a subsidy. What you're doing is you're giving them a reduced rate, and the presumption is that those reduced rates are still covering their incremental cost. So that really what you're doing is you're getting a new customer who otherwise wouldn't have been able to afford that higher rate, the standard rate. And they get, you know, because it's covering their incremental cost, they're likely to be, in fact, making a contribution to the overhead. And if you didn't pick them up otherwise, then the overheads are still there for everyone else to pick up. So I think you can structure it in such a way that, in fact, you're, all the ratepayers are better off because you've got another customer who's covering some overhead and covering their direct cost.
I have no problem with this provision. It's just something that was concerning me. Generally speaking, these institutions here that are listed, you know, university schools, the financial support of those institutions generally come from some governmental entity. So shifting that over to the private sector, so to speak, is good public policy. Representative Ruppert,
do
you have something to...
I don't know if it's, Mr. Chairman, if it's, I think there's a lot of education that this committee needs to do. We may want to hold back on certain questions until we have fuller membership. But it's like getting into definitions and things like that, which I think we all need to become up to speed on. I don't know if you want to venture into those areas at this time. I think I kind of am reluctant to ask some of those questions because I have plenty of others. So things like incremental costs, I'd really love to deal to dive into, but I don't know if today is the day to do that. But at this time, I'd like to ask a couple of questions, one of which really is really basic, fundamental, educational stuff because of my own ignorance, and that's, and perhaps Mr. Edrington or Mr. Foster could answer this. Could you kind of real quickly just outline the players involved in the state of Alaska in terms of local exchanges, cellular services in this area, the PSCs, and any other wireless or type of activities that we're all looking for in terms of trying to define what's been called the info bond that we're all focusing on? So I'd just kind of like to know who the players are and what... and how this whole thing fits together, because I'm not sure I understand that. Plus, Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to declare that I believe I own some stock in Nextel, so just to let everybody know.
So noted.
Mark, you want to do it? I'll take it. I'd be happy to take it, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Nextel is an interesting PCS kind of a company. They operate in SMDR, so it's an interesting investment. To my knowledge, they do not operate in the state of Alaska. The industry in Alaska is composed in the traditional telephone side of basically a number of local exchange carriers who provide local telephone service within specified geographies under a certificate of convenience and necessity, I believe they call it, from the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, which is fundamentally a license to be in the local telephone business in that geographic area. These companies range in size from ATU, which currently has about 146,000 lines and 100,000 households, down to companies such as Paula Eller runs, the Ruby Telephone Company, that has 50. And there are many, many shades in between. There are probably, what would you say, 15? Actually, Dave Rowe from the ATA is here. If I could, you know.
23.
Boy, I'll be darned. 23. 23 such local exchange carriers. There is also a network structure that connects for, quote, long distance in the state for communications, and the two people in that duopoly are GCI and AT&T Alascom. They are the two facilities-based carriers that I'm aware of that operate in the state of Alaska. Additionally, in the market, there are numerous cellular companies either owned by the wireline side, the local exchange side, or competitors. I'm not familiar personally with those markets. outside of Anchorage. In Anchorage, we have two cellular carriers, MacTel, which is owned by ATU in whole, and a company called Cellular One, which is soon to become AT&T Wireless, which is owned in whole by AT&T. Although exactly where, since AT&T is broken into three parts, I'm not sure.
That was last week, right?
That was last week. Yeah, it's a fast-moving world we're in, representing. The other communication players up here are often overlooked on the infobahn. We have the cable companies. Prime Cable is an excellent example. They're doing a fine job in the marketplace. They've recently upgraded their system to 71 channels. And are, I believe, in the process of beginning to contemplate offering interactive kinds of information services to subscribers over their cable system. We also have numerous private networks provided by major companies. The major oil companies, BP, ARCO, maintain their own networks, their own satellite capabilities, both up to Prudhoe and on down into Texas. So there's a whole nother layer of privately owned networks that customers communicate on and basically, in many cases, don't use our or the long-distance carrier's facilities. In other cases, they use a mixture of their own personally owned equipment and our equipment to construct private networks. So it really is quite a mishmash of capabilities out there.
What about the PCS? You mentioned there was that recent bidding.
There have been recent bidding on PCS licenses. PCS stands for Personal Communications Service, and it is a radio frequency service touted to be of low cost, in fact, lower cost than existing methods of reaching customers. I've never personally tried to buy the equipment, so I don't have a real feeling for whether that's true or not, but it is certainly billed as an alternative to the phone company for the provision of local telephone service. Two licenses for that have been sold for the state of Alaska in the federal auctions, one to GCI for, I believe, and I'll hear about it if I get it wrong, approximately $1.3 million. For the license for the state. The other was bought by a company that basically takes its parentage from TDS, and that license was purchased for $1 million for the state of Alaska to enter this kind of market and provide these services. There are other licenses yet to be auctioned off. There's a current auction that's undergoing some litigation right now, but should probably clear by the end of the year. They'll provide a third Alaska-wide licensing capability, and there are three additional licenses after that. So assuming different players purchased every license available in PCS for Alaska, in Anchorage you could have up to six people offering communication services via PCS to subscribers. Whether the market economically can support that or not is a whole other question.
Excuse me, you said, is that TBS, did you say? As in
TDS.
TDS.
Yes, Thomas Data System. Telecommunications
we
Data
had
Systems.
Ted Turner and Jane Fonda there for a minute.
I think they live in Montana.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, wait, a follow-up question?
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, the ballot proposition, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Edgington, that's going to be coming before the Anchorage voters, potentially, I guess, this spring. Could you comment on the impact? Is there not some prohibitions in that particular, or the way that's being structured as far as ATU's ability to provide long-distance service? And perhaps this bill and desire of this bill to allow ATU to be able to do that? Could you comment on that issue?
I can comment on it in certain sense, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, and that is, as I understand the contract terms that the city administration is making available to potential purchasers of ATU, there is a section in there that precludes a person who purchases ATU from entering the long-distance market for a period of 3 years. there's some doubt in my own mind as to when the clock starts on that. I presume personally it starts at the time of purchase. So that section is in there. As to the effect of it, I'm generally neutral on the sale issue, quite candidly. The effect, I believe, would be to diminish the sale value of the utility, simply from the viewpoint that it decreases the flexibility of the purchaser. But those things, again, are in the eyes of the beholder, and there may well be people in the market to which that restriction has no meaning.
Just in a brief nutshell, how will ATU benefit with the passage of this legislation?
ATU will benefit because it will move from the kind of operation and market it is in now into a competitive environment. And by moving into a competitive environment, it will become more cost-effective and more skilled at serving customers, and it will become a hunting cat. In many ways, the legislation today allows ATU to be sort of a complacent cat if it wants to be, and I don't believe that's a healthy condition. So I think the biggest benefit to ATU out of this is placing ATU and its culture into a competitive marketplace and allowing it to learn those skills and add value to the customer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Mr. Armquist, did you want to testify, or were you just here to observe and answer questions? Left? I guess he must have been observing. Mr. Rowe.
Chairman, thank you. I'm James Rowe, the Executive Director of the Alaska Telephone Association. I appreciate the time that this committee will give me to make comments in support of HB 346. I'd also like to convey my thanks and appreciation to Representative Moses for initiating a bill that is certainly in the interest of the citizens of our state. My written remarks are short. My verbal will be even shorter. Many of the states are facing local competition, have initiated local competition legislation. Certainly the federal government has been looking carefully at federal telecommunications legislation going toward competition for the last 2 years. The members of ATA have been following it, participating in it, trying to convey to our congressional delegation what we think would be in the interest of the citizens of Alaska. We think it's important that the state, regardless of what the federal government does, moves toward a local competition bill and does modernize our regulations regarding telecommunications legislation. As we look at aspects of this bill, our state is fairly unique in its size, in its environment, in the geography, and the challenges that we face in bringing telecommunications to all our citizens. Key aspects are enumerated here. Universal service at affordable rates. Universal service is two things. It is the people we reach, and it is the services that are available to them. We don't want to be behind the rest of this nation. Affordable rates are such that our citizens can afford to have that service. We would like to see competition presumed to be in the public interest in large urban markets. We would like to recognize that competition or regulation are tools to serve our public. Neither one is a goal. We would like competition to be presumed not to be in the public interest in rural markets. And the determination in both of these markets would certainly be up to State Commission. In markets that are competitive, there must be a level playing field. Reasonable costs that local exchange providers incur to permit competitors to use the local exchange network should be borne by the competitor. Regulation in all competitive markets should be minimal. I think the bill that Representative Moses has introduced is an initial effort. I think there will be many parties offering to Representative Moses ideas in the process, and ATA will certainly be looking forward to working with the legislature and Representative Moses in offering ideas that will make this a more detailed bill, a more detailed piece of legislation, and of even greater benefit to our citizens. Can I answer any of your questions?
Hey, Mr. Rowe, I have a question here on number two, competition is presumed to be public interest in large urban markets. How would you qualify or quantify large in Alaska? When I think of large urban markets, I think of Fairbanks, Juneau, Anchorage.
And we appreciate that very much, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe in Wasilla.
We're afraid very much that our people in Washington look at rural and they don't really have the concept of rural as we experience it. And when they think of large markets, they're probably not even thinking of Anchorage. And I think the federal legislation has the potential to overlook areas that we think are small, they think are non-existent. Areas that we think, like Wasilla, that maybe are at least moderate in size, might not even count. And when they look at rural, I have a feeling they're looking at the southern part of the Shenandoah Valley, and they're not looking at Kaktovik and Anantuvik Pass. I appreciate that our state legislature will look a little bit more closely at the harm that can be done if we're cursory in the judgments we make that competition does serve all our citizens everywhere and does benefit the public interest. I think it will be up to the state entity, the APUC, to determine what those large markets are. I don't have any number. I think we need to look at our state, and those you enumerated quite likely are large markets. I think there are some that we know are small. On the other hand, there are always the ones in the middle that there probably will be differences on. Is Dutch Harbor large or small? On the other hand, the perception you give is somebody from the valley, and that's certainly different than somebody from the Shenandoah Valley would give or what is small or large.
President Roeckberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rowe, could you kind of refresh my memory and edify the committee on maybe the historic background or the present status of the cost of or existence of any subsidies to rural Alaska and how that works now in terms of long distance? You understand my question?
Yes, I think I do. And as Mr. Foster said, he might not describe some things as subsidy. And I do understand it depends on which side you're looking at. But we have essentially some areas of the United States are much easier to serve by a low-cost dollar local telephone or long-distance telephone for that matter. You have economies of scale. We're a long distance from many places, many strong urban centers, where you have so many more people in the loop. Let me suggest, though, that it's not a subsidy, that the person in L.A. or Chicago or New York who wants to call their grandparent or their child in Anantuvik Pass is buying part of a larger, more valuable network, even though they can make a local call perhaps cheaper than they can make the one up there, and I'm not talking about the toll service of long distance. It is a subsidy in a sense, yes. It might cost us $100 to put a customer on a line, and there might be a share, a very small share of each phone call that is made long distance outside that is contributing to the rate beyond the $20 perhaps local phone rate that person pays just to be on. We also realize that many of the people in small communities in remote parts of Alaska pay a much higher percentage of toll, because they don't really need to call the 135 people in their own community that are available by local service. Many of their phone calls are going to Fairbanks, so they have a proportionately much higher toll bill than people might where I'm from in Lexington, Kentucky. think what we can see, if what you're calling a subsidy, this fractional part that of each access charge that is going to defray these rates through Universal Service Fund, and what we call DEM weighting, which is dial equipment minutes that are proportioned higher in small communities that have smaller switches, it comes from a national source, but it also lets the people in that national network be able to participate in a larger network than they would be able to do if they didn't contribute to that. They are buying part of the service. They're purchasing the service to reach the high-cost areas, and I think that's a more appropriate perspective to take than they are subsidizing the people there.
Chairman, to follow up on that then, that what you're saying is, like, the State of Alaska's general fund does not directly, if you will, add dollars to the long-distance toll charges to anybody in the state. Is that, would that be a fair statement? I mean, in terms of individual...
I don't think we do. I don't think a lot of Alaska can afford to have telephone if we're not part of the system.
Now, yeah. Through the chair, were the installation of most of these telephone satellite stations in the state, were they done by the local exchanges, or did the state historically invest any funds into that infrastructure?
Or? Sorry, Representative Rookberg, you're beyond my level of expertise.
Okay. But the grandparents in L.A. are actually paying money into the Universal Service Fund, which is redistributed to the, if you will, like the local exchange. Is that how that works?
To the customer. For the construction of the infrastructure to reach the customer, yes.
So the person in Anchorage is not more proportionally helping to subsidize, using my word, forgive me, than the person in L.A. to that person in Antietam Pass, to use your example. We're not paying more here, are we, then?
No.
Well, that's good for a change. Gosh.
We have affordable rates, sir.
Right. And certain public, there's certain institutional uses like RATNET and things of that nature, aren't they carried over the long-distance telephone lines, or are they a separate satellite?
I'm sure there's another party here who could answer that accurately for you.
Well, I think I've exhausted all of them.
You've exhausted your quarter's worth of money. 3 minutes to put on the optical telephone. Mr. Rowe, on your fifth statement here, can you give me just an example of how this would work when we're talking about the local exchange providers charging a reasonable cost to
yes.
its competitors for the use of its network? Can you elaborate on that, what
yes.
that really means?
I sure can, Mr. Chairman. We are looking at a competitor coming in wanting access to the customers, essentially, that are served by wire by the local service provider. There are costs entailed in having that wire go to those homes. There are costs entailed in the records keeping, the administrative procedure, the personnel that are involved with having installed it, having developed it, and keeping it running. If a competitor comes in, as in a competitive market, as they should, and have access to some of those customers or all of those customers, they need to share in the cost, not only of the electric current that goes down the wire that moment, but essentially of the cost of having that infrastructure built, of retiring the debt, of the administrative costs that are entailed in keeping it running, and the additional cost of figuring out who's paying for what part of the function of that, the delivery of the service now.
Would that be concerned more with local service or long-distance service, or equally with both?
I'm looking particularly at local service on that. And that might be my perspective as the representative of the local exchange community.
Okay. Further questions? Being none. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much
for your testimony. Mr. Ted Meninsky.
Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Ted Menensky. I am the Regulatory Affairs Director for AT&T Alascom, and served in a similar capacity with the company before it became AT&T Alascom, back when it was Alascom. And I'm here to provide some comments this afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity on House Bill 346. And my comments will be relatively brief, and in fact, I probably should begin by apologizing. I don't have written comments prepared for you. I intend to pull them together and give them to you along with some additional information that I'll make reference to as I speak to you this afternoon. One of the things that you've heard so far today, and perhaps you've heard even before this hearing was convened, is that there is a fair amount of support for this bill from the local exchange industry. And I'm sitting in front of you representing the long-distance industry, the inter-exchange industry, and representing my company in particular. But AT&T Alascom doesn't view House Bill 346 as simply being a local exchange bill. As its name would suggest to you, this is a telecommunications bill. And the policies and the specific components of the bill that the legislature will consider and perhaps adopt will affect local exchange, inter-exchange carriers, it will affect the industry as a whole. And I think, generally speaking, AT&T Alaska believes that this is an appropriate time for us to be having this discussion. You've heard information this afternoon about the state of telecommunications throughout the country. You've heard about pending federal legislation. We've heard about concepts of competition. And I think all of those are real, and we all accept that reality and believe that we need to begin to answer some of the questions. As I have reviewed this proposed legislation, and as it's been reviewed by others in my company, we come to the conclusion that there are some things in it that we think are good, and there are some things in it that we have some genuine objection to and some real concerns and reservations about. And I'd like to briefly tell you a little bit about that and then try and respond to some questions if you have any, and also try and get down to further levels of specifics as Representative Roepberg suggests as we move through the process. One of the concerns that we have has to do with the provisions of the bill that talk about interconnection. And we've heard some comments about interconnection. One of the people who talked about interconnection, I believe it was Mr. Shushan, had indicated that we need to have a certain symmetry in the interconnection. The rules have to be fair and reasonable, and they have to cut both ways. And I think, again, generally speaking, AT&T Alaska probably would agree with that. You're going to find that we agree with a lot of the conceptual comments and the philosophical comments that you've heard today. But as we all know, the devil's in the detail, and when we get down into the detail of the bill, we have some issues. Interconnection, as it applies to companies or new entities or new competitors that want to move into the local exchange business, is a significant issue, because right now we know that local exchange companies, generally speaking, throughout the country as well as here in Alaska, function in a monopoly situation. Mr. Edrington had indicated that technology has pretty much broken those barriers down, and I certainly would agree that there is some potential for those barriers to come down. But I think in the final analysis, when we take a look at the local exchange industry today, we find that local companies control the vast majority, the substantial majority of the access to the end user. So for competitors and for inter-exchange carriers, just in their normal course of business, to reach those end users, you have to come through the local exchange company. And so the interconnection requirements to get to the end user and the interconnection requirements to become a competitive provider of local exchange services is a significant element. We, I think, can readily recognize and readily agree that companies are not going to have the resources to come into Alaska or into any of the metropolitan areas throughout the country and simply rebuild a local exchange company's plant and facilities. It would simply be cost prohibitive. And so there has to be ways, as we have experienced on the long distance side, of competitors coming into the marketplace and facing fair and reasonable rates and conditions in order to resell the services and the facilities of the existing incumbent carrier. That was certainly true when long distance inter-exchange service entered the Alaska market. Alaska's facilities, by the rules that were put in place legislatively and by the PUC, must be made available for resale to GCI and other competitors. That's how competition rolled forward, and it's those interconnection specifics that we take. We have some concerns about. We believe that the existing language in House Bill 346 will make it difficult for competitors to enter those local markets. It will make it easy for local exchange companies for fairly undefined reasons in many instances to simply not allow that interconnection or to slow that interconnection down, and then ultimately to slow down competition. There's another section or series of sections in House Bill 346 that we have some concern about, and I'll be very careful about how I present my concerns because I wouldn't want you to get the wrong impression. And that has to do with the deregulation of competitive services. AT&T Alaskom is before you this afternoon being a strong proponent of lessened regulation, being a strong proponent of increased competition. And so we don't want to suggest to you that we think deregulation of competitive services is a bad idea. There is some concern, though, again, as you get into the specific provisions of House Bill 346, that the way you go about doing that operates in a fair and equitable way so that competitors have this overused term. You'll hear it today and probably again and again, that these competitors face a level playing field. And we've heard some comments today about, you know, we're talking about having competition that is fair and reasonable, not necessarily to the competitor. And I understand that nuance. But in order for competition to produce the results that you expect from it, then those specifics, that playing field, does have to be fair and reasonable and allow for access to the marketplace. And if you have a situation where any entity, whether it's a local exchange company or AT&T Alaskom or anybody, has the ability to sort of, on its own, without any real guidelines, deregulate certain products and services, then you're going to find an imbalance in that playing field. You're going to have a situation where, because a company is the incumbent carrier, it will be able to take advantage of that opportunity to drive its prices down, to competitively posture itself in a way that will make it difficult for competitive entry. And I think that's the policy decision that you're going to deal with and come to grips with, is how do we establish a framework that allows competition to come into being and to prosper? So we have some concerns about the way that competitive deregulation takes place, not the concept of competitive deregulation itself. We certainly believe in that. We hope that that happens. We hope that to the extent that we will work together on the bill as it moves through the process, that we can help that happen more effectively. The third thing that we're a little concerned about is a debate that is occurring nationally, and even though it's a lower 48 issue at the moment, AT&T Alaska believes it's an issue in Alaska as well. And it has to do with the sequencing of market entry, buzzword. What comes first? It's kind of a cart and a horse theory. Do you allow a participant who effectively operates as a monopoly to move into competitive markets before that entity's own market has become competitive? Or do you do the reverse? Do you say, let's go to this monopoly market and let's cause competition to come into being and to be demonstrated in that monopoly market, and then we'll allow those entities to move into other pre-existing competitive markets? And that's really what we're facing when you look at local exchange markets and inter-exchange markets, long-distance markets. Right now, the local exchange market, in my opinion, for all intent and purposes, is a monopoly market. The inter-exchange markets, the long-distance markets, I believe are, if not competitive, well on their way to being competitive. Should we allow that local market, that local exchange market, to remain in sort of monopoly status or near monopoly status, and then let that local company move into long-distance competition while still kind of hanging on to the monopoly? Or do we do it the reverse? Do we cause the local market to be opened up, to become competitive, to be tested to show that it is competitive, and then allow the migration into other markets for competition? Again, no one's arguing that any of those markets should remain monopolies. Everybody is agreeing that all of those markets should become competitive, at least to the extent that the market will allow it to happen. The question is sequencing. What happens first? AT&T Alaskom thinks that the legislature has some options, and certainly the bill before you is the first step in the process. Mr. Edrington, I think, mentioned that this is not a radical bill, it's not a new bill. Lots of other states have moved in the direction of implementing competitive structures and competitive processes in their states. I agree with that. In fact, just before leaving the office to come and visit with you today, I managed to get my hands on a copy of Hawaii House Bill 471. And this was a bill that was recently adopted in Hawaii, and although I don't have copies for you immediately, I'll be sure that you have them in short order. Hawaii House Bill 471 produces the balance, I think, that AT&T Alascom would advocate and would hope for. It acknowledges the fact that we need to have a transition plan to competitive markets. It provides for, over some period of time, the plan to get us there. It doesn't hold any particular markets in a pure monopoly status for any length of time. And again, our opinion is that this bill presents an interesting and useful model to you, and perhaps there are others. We'll look for them and share them with you as we find them. But at least this one presents an interesting model to you that will give you some countervailing theories and concepts to House Bill 346. The Hawaii bill does some things that I think are kind of interesting, and I won't give you all the details, but it certainly provides for the access to various networks on reasonable terms and conditions for new entrants into the marketplace. It specifically provides for a universal service program, and we've heard concerns and issues expressed today about universal service. We're concerned about that too, but again, I mean, universal service defined how? Some of the mechanisms that you've heard talked about today are mechanisms that were established and defined many years ago at the time when most of the markets were in a monopoly situation. And so the ability to recover cost and share cost was different than it is today. The world is changing, the telecommunications markets are changing, and it's just not clear to me that those old mechanisms will continue to function effectively the way that perhaps they once did. That doesn't mean we abandon the notion. It does mean, though, that we take a look at some new ideas and some new ways of reaching those goals. The other thing that the Hawaii bill does, too, it makes a fairly clear prescription of events that need to take place, in particular in the local exchange market. It talks about, you heard Mr. Shushan mention, I believe, unbundling services, the notion that companies must sell their services in piece parts so that what a competitive entrant may need can be purchased at the levels that they need them. There's other issues, too, in terms of access to network, the pricing of networks, fair and non-discriminatory access to networks. All of those issues, I believe, are covered and covered fairly effectively in the Hawaii bill. So I'd offer that to you again as another option for your consideration, another way to put the issues out on the table. I think that Mr. Shushan also mentioned that our current regulatory structure, the current enabling legislation that exists in Alaska today is probably old. Mr. Foster mentioned that too, that it was put on the books back in the 1970s. Does it need to be changed? I suspect so. I mean, I don't think AT&T Alaskan is going to sit here and say the statute should be left alone, HB 346 should go away. In fact, some of the changes that we think need to happen are not necessarily changes that were driven by House Bill 346, but are changes that need to occur in the existing statute because of the changing environment that we operate in. Notions of lessened regulation, access to markets, access to networks are all things that probably needed to be talked about anyway, and House Bill 346 will give us that opportunity. I think with that, I'll thank you again for the chance to give you some preliminary comments. If you have any initial questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Any questions? Only one. Representative
Rumford. Mr. Chairman, you know, from the work session, I recall something, and maybe just something we should inform everybody of. Any specific written comments on the bill? I think it would be helpful for us if we got it in a sectional analysis format. I think that helps us, and it's our normal modus operandi in reviewing legislation. So if there's going to be further hearings and further testimony on this bill in a written nature, that if we could get it in that format, that would be helpful. If the chair agrees with that.
Thank you, Representative Roper. That seems to be a reasonable request. So if anyone has any comments regarding the bill that you want to provide to us in written format, if you would reference the section that you're dealing with. Some of these areas are pretty complex. And in fact, when you get into 8, 9, and 10, 11, there's some meshing, I think, ongoing that probably deserves to be separated. So if you would, and if there are any areas as you address the bill that you look at favorably, that would be certainly appreciative as well. There's probably, I'm sure, some good points in this legislation that all parties can agree to. Maybe we ought to start there and take whatever we agree with and then work forward. That may be helpful as well. So if you would. Thank you. Again, if there's nothing we can agree with, then
agree on, agree to disagree. Next, Mr. Jackson. Please come forward and tell us everything we want to know about DCI's perspective on House Bill 346.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Jimmy Jackson, and I'm a regulatory attorney for GCI. I would probably agree with you that there are things in the bill with which we might agree. However, I will begin by saying that as written, GCI opposes HB 346 for the reason that it does not encourage competition. It discourages competition. As I will explain, the bill puts the cart before the horse. It has the cart hooked up facing the wrong direction, and at least one of the wheels on the cart is broken off. The current trend in telecommunications today is competition at the local level, competition in the service that ATU and the other local phone companies provide. It's probably in about the state that long-distance competition was maybe 20 years ago. I don't know exactly what the right length of time it was, but it's comparable to the state that long-distance competition was quite some time ago, with perhaps one major exception. Many states, state legislatures, and state utility commissions have looked at what competition has done in the long-distance market and in a few other telecommunications market, and has generally realized that competition has done good things, and that perhaps in the area of local competition, we don't have to quite fight about it for 10 years or so that it took GCI to get into the market here, that we can just recognize that competition will do good things, and so we should put it in place and then get on with it. I have a story from a trade publication here from Telecom Publishing Group, and it's regarding state telephone regulation. And the headline of this article is, "New Actions Make It 21 States That Allow Full Local Competition." That is the degree of the trend. However, as of now, there is yet very little actual competition at the local level. ATU and other local phone companies face a little bit of competition around the fringes of what they do. But none of us has a real alternative to the local phone company at our home or at our business in terms of where we're going to get our phone service. And it's going to bring good things, but it's not here yet. And in that context, there are two very different set of issues that need to be addressed regarding local competition. The first is the set of issues that need to be addressed in order to let local competition happen. This bill does nothing in that regard. It is supposedly to encourage competition. You cannot find those words in the bill. One would think that it would say, local phone service competition should be encouraged. It doesn't say that. It doesn't even say it shall be allowed. Not only does it not even make the statement that local phone competition is allowed and should be encouraged, there are a host of issues that have to be addressed before local phone service competition can happen. And Mr. Meninsky and some of the other people talked about some of these. Interconnection is the most basic. If I'm in the competitive local phone business and I want to go to you to get you to sign up for my business, you obviously will not sign up for my business if you can't call any of the people who remain on ATU's system. So you have to have interconnection between the two networks so that the people who sign up for the new provider can call the people who are still on the old provider. Interconnection in this business means much more than that. And these are some of the kind of details that have to be worked out, which are totally unaddressed. For instance, one is called number portability. The particular phone number that people have, and particularly that businesses have, is often very important to them. My parents own a bookstore, and they have the phone number 782-BOOK, B-O-O-K. We're all familiar. You see a lot with 800 numbers. Frequently it is because the number
describes the business in some way. And even if you don't have that, any business has stationery, advertisements, all sorts of things that have their phone number already there. They have a real problem going to a new customer if they have to change their phone number. Now, this is something that the long distance company went through with 800 numbers. Now, if you have an 800 number and you change from Alascom to GCI or vice versa, from AT&T to MCI, you keep your same 800 number. You do not have to give up your number when you change carriers. That's also necessary at the local level in order to have any real competition at the local level. There must be something called dialing parity, which means that you don't have the situation that you may remember for a long time ago, where if you wanted to use GCI as your long-distance carrier, you had to dial a long series of numbers as compared to using Alascom, where you only had to dial the 7 numbers plus the area code. The local phone customers can't be required to dial, say, 10 numbers, while the new competitors' customers can't be required to dial, say, 10 numbers, while the existing carrier's customers only dial 7 numbers. It's a major barrier. Again, it's something that has to be worked out in the interconnection. These are the kind of issues which are addressed in by the legislation in other states where they say they're going to have full local competition, because you can't have it without addressing these matters. But the bill that's been put forward thus far doesn't address those issues. Instead, it addresses only the second set of issues. And that second set of issues concern the changes in the regulations.